The opinions and ideas expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those held by Hamilton College, WHCL-FM as a whole, or the trustees of Hamilton College.
Hey, good morning. You're listening to WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco. This show is titled The Ringer. And this morning, Veterans Day, I have a special program for you. Just yesterday evening, Kathy Kelly spoke at the Unitarian Church in Syracuse. And I was fortunate to be there and record it. So this is Kathy Kelly speaking from last night about the drones to be stationed at Hancock International Airport Base.
Bombs are stationed here in Syracuse. And today, we're very, very thrilled to have Kathy Kelly here and talk about her experiences in Gaza and Pakistan, including interviews with drone survivors there. And then on Sunday, we'll actually go and take all this knowledge and protest the drones in Syracuse. So how today is going to work is Kathy's going to talk for about half an hour or so, and she'll have questions and answers after that. And then we'll have John Boulay, who has been one of the three Johns who had been researching the drones for the last year. He'll talk about more of the specifics about the drones in Syracuse. And we'll tell you about the protests coming up. And we'll also have a special guest treat. And that's a good reminder. If you have a cell phone, if you could please put it on vibrate or just turn it off right now, that would be wonderful. So we're delighted to have Kathy Kelly back. She spoke at our birthday dinner 3 years ago. And she's on a tour of upstate New York, in addition to other places, to, as I said, talk about her experience in Gaza, where she was in January at the time of the bombing of the Israelis on Gaza. And also, she was recently in Pakistan. Through her tour, she's been encouraging people throughout upstate New York to come to Syracuse on Sunday to protest the drones. So it's been a really lucky thing that Kathy has set up this tour at this particular time, and there is a lot of interest regionally in this. People across the region do feel a sense of ownership of the fact that these drones are in their region. As many of you know, and if you are not familiar with Kathy, you're in for a real treat. She's the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, traveled to Iraq many times, bringing humanitarian supplies and breaking the sanctions. There are people here who joined her on some of those trips, and is currently the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And now I'd like to welcome Kathy Kelly up here.
Good evening. I'm very happy to be back in Syracuse again and to see familiar faces and to be welcomed by Carol and to know that we can look forward to hearing from local experts and certainly the three Johns where people started galvanizing much more intense interest in Chicago and other places regarding the drones. I'm someone who grew up on the southwest side of Chicago when it was common for planes from Midway Airport to fly overhead, and as a recreation, we used to count the planes flying overhead. We never could imagine being on a plane in those days. We certainly wouldn't imagine a plane attacking us. These were very secure times in some ways, although I grew up in a neighborhood fraught by problems related to racism and militarism. One of the other aspects of my growing up years was something I can kind of capsulize as being said by my mother, like I think Irish brogue. We were to fit in. We were, you know, not to rock the boat. It was okay to talk about a problem, but if you thought you could do something about it, you were clearly stepping beyond a line. As my mother would put it, now, Kathy, make sure you're not acting too big for your britches. I was never quite sure what it meant to act too big for your britches, but I wish I didn't want to be caught to that. But there's another line that I came across more recently that also refers to that sense of fatalism, that you can't do something to change something. And it comes from a novel by Jane Ann Phillips. And the words are placed on the lips of a war-weary soldier. He's in Korea in the 50s, and he's in love. And he wants to go home to his sweetheart. He's sick and tired of the war. And he says, the planes always come, like planets on rotation, a timed bloodletting with different excuses. I'll just say that one more time. The planes always come, like planets on rotation, a timed bloodletting with different excuses. One of the more recent timed bloodlettings of which I was told happened in a small village called Hysor. It's so small with just 500 people and so remote in North Waziristan, located in Pakistan, that there's not even a road leading up to it. And the person who came to tell me about the drone attack that he had survived had in fact gone on foot and taken two buses and taken considerable risk to come and talk to our small delegation in Rawalpindi in Pakistan and tell us about the experiences of people in his village. Now it's important to know in that community where he grew up that there's a custom which is obligatory. If a stranger knocks at your door and you have food in your house, you share your food. It's not like you can say, well, the 7-Eleven is that way and there's a Motel 6 over there. If you don't share with a stranger and the stranger has to go on a journey without water, without food, the stranger might not survive. And so for as long as people could remember, generation after generation, it's been the custom and the obligation that if someone comes to your door and knocks, you share food. So this happened on May 14th. Three strangers came to Hysor, and they knocked on the door of a family where village elders lived, and they were given a meal and something to drink, and they were long gone. At 4:30 in the morning, a drone aircraft that might have picked up surveillance that showed these strangers coming to the door fired two Hellfire missiles into the home. Immediately, two elders were killed. They were among 14 killed. Some children were dismembered. There were people at risk of bleeding to death. And at that point, I asked the person speaking with us about this, what do you do if there's no fire station and no EMTs? And he said, just madame, you see the tabutha you are wearing now, the long scarf that all Pakistani women would wear. He said, we take this and wrap it around the person as tight as we can to stop the bleeding. And I could imagine my long white scarf, scarlet red, in seconds. And then we put the person on our shoulders and we try to get to the road as fast as we can. But then it was so difficult for him to tell the next part. They had gotten the survivors to the road and they're bleeding massively and they flagged down a car and the car stopped, but the driver heard what had happened. And the driver, understandably afraid that the drone might still be picking up surveillance of who is involved with this family in Hysor, the driver sped off. And you see how these drones, they change us. And he told me that everybody uses the cell phone to send messages. This bloody thing has happened again. Even the children, when they're gathered to play, if they hear the drone overhead, they scatter. And even at the time of prayer after someone has died, when people come to read about this actually after I'd come back to the United States, the village of Lataka, I believe it was June 24th, five Taliban group members had been killed. Maybe they were leaders. And there were many people who had gathered for funeral prayers. But as would happen in my family, and maybe in yours, some stayed on. There were 60 people remaining. And that's when the drone hit those who remained, and 35 people were killed instantly, and 10 of them were children. And of course, the word goes out, this bloody thing has happened again. The drones are astonishing in the surveillance that they can pick up. If you read Jane Meyer's very fine article, although written from a militarist perspective, in the New Yorker, you realize that from 2 miles up in the air, they were able to even see Baitullah Masood, a Taliban leader, on the rooftop of his in-law's home on an IV drip while his medical care was being taken care of by the in-laws, and the drone could see all that and communicate the information back, and then the missile hit and killed everybody on that rooftop. The drones are able to accomplish tremendous surveillance as they participate, in a sense, in the extrajudicial assassinations. But what the drones can't tell us is what would prompt someone to join a Taliban group in the first place. And for that kind of understanding, I think we're set well on our way if we return to the Riverside Church, to the 1967 speech by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And he had the gall at that time to say to the assembled people and to the world, the people in the United States at war in Vietnam must learn how to love the Viet Cong. How shall we update that speech for our time now? They're hard words to say. How shall we love the Taliban groups? How shall we love Al-Qaeda? I don't think we can do a disservice to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and not search for answers to those questions. And he helps us out. He gives us the guidance. He says, first of all, you have to try to see yourselves as you are seen by your adversary. And might we not almost seem like Martians from another planet with our extraordinary weaponry? And he says you have to be able to see the humanity in your adversary. And when we ask ourselves, who would join these Taliban groups? Shouldn't we be asking ourselves about statistics related to poverty in both Pakistan and Afghanistan? Now, that's a small chance to get a glimpse. You know, there were 3.1 million people who'd been displaced by the military offensive that the United States is all too ready to say was a great success in the Swat Valley. And we met people when we were there who were destitute. They'd been one step away from destitution. They were terrified, alarmed. What happens if our livestock have thirsted to death or starved to death? They didn't have some backup means of livelihood. What would they do if their shop was demolished, if their home was destroyed? How would they cope with their crops that they couldn't harvest? What vegetables would they sell for the coming months? And people were very, very frightened. And they also told us with alarm about how they had tried to dig mass graves in order to bury people as they were racing out of the town when the military curfew was lifted. Well, later, when I was back in the United States, I read, even in the New York Times, that their nightmare fears had come true, that 251 corpses were scattered around the city of Mingora, and parents were afraid to let their kids play by the river because corpses were floating downriver. And there indeed had been executions and torture and mutilated bodies found, and the crops had been harvested and the livestock had died. And I just read recently that 20 United Nations organized feeding stations were closed down, leaving 2.3 million people at risk of not having enough food. Do we think that the spirals of reprisal and retaliation won't be set in action, even as the United States diplomats and generals are slapping one another on the back and saying, gee, that was a success? And so I think one of our tasks is to understand more deeply the sorrow of war. I had one experience and perhaps understanding that at a deeper level than I'd understood before when I was in Gaza. And there, the drones were circling overhead. You didn't know it. Perhaps the drone was picking up surveillance over the houses below. Were we at some considerable risk? And the bombing that happened in Gaza between the hours of 11 until 1, once every 11 minutes, and then for a lull, and then again between the hours of 3 and 6 in the morning, once every 11 minutes, was such that I'm not a militarist, but even I could tell, oh, that was a Hellfire missile fired by an Apache helicopter. You know, that bomb was a 500-pound bomb dropped by an F-16. And the bombing was relentless, and the children could tell which kinds of weapons were being used against them. But the doctors that we met with in the Shifa hospital were shaken. You expect surgeons to be cool, calm, and collected, but the doctors, like Dr. Nafaz Abu Shadab, said, really, we do not know all what was used against us. And he began to talk about the consequences of white phosphorus bombing and dense inert metal explosion bombing. And at one point when I talked with a woman named Saba Abu Hadami, I thought, well, maybe she's on medication and nightmares have mixed with reality and what she's describing isn't as she said. And wanting to find out more, we gave her a hug goodbye, you know, dug out whatever money we could lay hands on so that she wouldn't be completely bereft. And we went to her home in the Al-Atatra area, and her story was corroborated later by Sabrina Tavernis writing for the New York Times. And Sabrina Tavernis wrote that the tank-fired white phosphorus missiles were intended to mask troop movements, but instead they breathed their fire and smoke into the hallway of Saba Abu Halimi's home, burning her husband, her three children, and her baby daughter to death. And then the Israeli soldiers, for some reason, maybe because her home was a little higher than others, had opted to occupy her home. And so next to the room that was charred and blackened, where people had huddled because there was no window and they thought they might escape the bombing and the tank-fired missiles, next to that room was a ransacked room. All of the cabinets were turned upside down, the drawers were emptied out, but written on the wall in that room, in perfect Arabic script, the words, Min Jeish Israel, from the Israeli army, Nachnu Sifa, we're sorry. And I believe it. I believe the soldiers who are in the war zones feel the sorrow of war. And I think we've seen that also from our soldiers in Afghanistan. There was a report April 8th about, well, it was in the Agence France press. It actually didn't turn up in the press here. But there was bad information obtained, maybe through torture, maybe through paying a bribe, maybe through the surveillance of a drone aircraft. But the information said that the home of a man named Brigadier Artillery Commander Awa Khan, who lived in the village of Ali Dawa in the coast province of Afghanistan, was a bad guy. The information said that this man, an Afghan man who actually was working with the U.S. military, was part of a Taliban group. And so United States soldiers had gone to the home opposite his home, broken in, went up to the rooftop and stationed themselves. And then another group of U.S. soldiers burst into the home of the Afghan brigadier commander while he was away. His family members thought it must be robbers. They ran up to the rooftop. As soon as they emerged on the rooftop, the U.S. soldiers opposite opened fire and they killed Awal Khan's brother, his wife, his 17-year-old daughter, Naja, 15-year-old son, Imam. And running down the way from three doors down was his cousin, and she was 9 months pregnant. And they shot into her belly, riddling her belly, and the baby in her womb was killed. And when Lieutenant Colonel Julian from the United States heard what had happened, he wrote a heartfelt letter And he said to the family, to the survivors, "We're sorry. We're so very sorry." And I believe it, that the sorrow of war, the sorrow over where our scientists and our resources and our productivity are being directed might not be adequately felt yet here. And that's part of our job. And that's why we must act too big for our britches. That's why I believe we must overcome any kind of fatalism right now, because we have a chance, we have an extraordinary opportunity to start to turn and turn and turn this country toward that point, which I believe 50 years hence will be the reality. War will be consigned to the dustbin of history. This is an incredible opportunity for us. But we'll have to be strong in saying that wars are counterproductive, they're futile, and they don't solve problems. And in this particular case, with regard to Afghanistan, and it's not looking great in terms of whether or not President Obama would refuse to send the troops that the generals are requiring, nevertheless, I think we have to acknowledge that the United States lacks the moral authority, the financial ability, and the military means to occupy Afghanistan and wage ongoing war. Even if they had the financial strength and the military means, I believe it would be wrong. I believe we could work to end all wars. And part of where we can start is in enunciating the sorrow. And so I would like to ask you to either come along with me or go along with me on a song that some of us sang when we were kids. When Johnny comes right home again. The original song was an Irish ballad, and in deference to my dear Irish mother, I would like to recall the words to the song, "While on the road to sweet a thief, haroo, haroo." And this was a ballad sung about the returning soldier who lost his eye and lost his arms and lost his leg. They're rolling out the guns again, haroo, haroo. They're rolling out the guns again, haroo, haroo. They're rolling out the guns again. They'll never take our sons again. No, they'll never take our sons again. Johnny comes wearing. Let's be sure about that. They'll never take our sons again. I have a waltz and maps, and I'm going to ask Doug for his kind help. And just to say that the light is a bit difficult here. We might get one. There we go. The place where the fighting is happening in north and south Waziristan right now is an inset. And you can see that Pakistan and Afghanistan share that long border, but then there's also a long border between Pakistan and Iran. And is it possible that the United States is very concerned about Pakistan's border with Iran and with China, and that the United States would like to use Pakistani military movement to shore up some United States national interests? Could we go to the next slide? And the next. Thank you. These kids aren't taking a nap. When Dan Pearson and I wrote an article about them, we called it Down and Out in Shah Mansur. Because these kids were dehydrated, they were exhausted from not getting adequate food and water, and whenever they were up, the dad or the grandfather had to carry them. And they were in 117 degree temperatures, staying inside tents, but they were maybe a little bit better off than some other people who really hadn't had anywhere to go but were afraid to go to the government-sponsored camps. And they had fled from the Swat Valley during the time of this military offensive that created 3.1 million refugees, some of whom had earlier fled the Taliban. And this youngster, perhaps when he grows older, would be vulnerable to recruitment into a group that might say, "We can give you dignity, we can give you food, we can give you education." And that group might in fact be Taliban groups who say that the will of Islam, the will of Allah, is for him to be able to be part of a group that would no longer be in debt to the landlords or in debt to the moneylenders, a kind of a Robin Hood understanding. But perhaps there is an alternative, and people around the world who are concerned about terrorist groups could say, we recognize the terror that our militaries inflict, and if we pull back the funds we put into our militaries, we could feed a hungry world. We could end disease. Mm-hmm. Often when you're in a setting where there are many children and you have a camera, the kids come running, Sora, Sora, they want their picture taken. There's not a smile on the faces of any of these children. And they're very concerned because they can tell their parents are deeply frightened. Yeah. So as the sun went down, this was the camp, the United Nations High Commission of Refugees camp. But really the majority of the people who had fled weren't in any kind of a camp. And they were staying in abandoned hospitals, they were staying in schools that weren't in session, staying with family members, and so many of them were people who were very, very alarmed about what would happen to them next. And perhaps some were part of Taliban groups that went deeper into the cities. Pakistan has paid a terrible price for the military offensives. Just in the month of October, 250 civilians were murdered in the reprisals, and many, many, many more wounded. The Helmand province in Afghanistan is reddened on this map. The United States had poured troops and finances and energy into trying to secure that one province. There are 364 districts in Afghanistan, and then there are these provinces that are larger areas. And I think the United States analysts thought, well, surely in Helmand, we can get people to turn out and vote, and this will be kind of a model for the rest of Afghanistan. So the voting happened. Do you know what the voter turnout was? 1 to 5% of people turned out to vote, even with military presence there. And in 2003, 30 of the 364 districts in Afghanistan were controlled by the Taliban. Now, there are 164 districts controlled by the Taliban. Wouldn't it be true to say that in every instance, the Taliban groups have coerced people into submitting to their control? There are people who say, we would rather link up with Taliban fighters than be governed by the Karzai government's corruption if they are in opposition to that government, or be linked up to infidels from across the world who are bombing us with their drone airplanes. That's us. And I think we have to ask that question again and again. What do Afghans want? It's not easy to get the answers, but maybe through polling, as much as through voting efforts, it is possible to get some insight. So I ask us all to pay attention to the most recent BBC poll. This set of statistics I gave you came from January 2009, but I've been on the road. I haven't been able to look at the most recent poll. In Pakistan, this map was well known amongst people who were English-speaking elite affluent groups. They are perhaps more likely to see the United States as an ally than the 70% of the country who are desperately impoverished. But even amongst that group, there is the suspicion of this map. You notice on the side to my far left, it's an imaginary map. The side closer to me is the real map. But in the imagined map, a CIA analyst had wondered, well, what if we created free Baluchistan and ended the border between Iran and Pakistan? Well, there is a Baluchistani separatist movement going on. And then what if Afghanistan were to kind of curl over Pakistan? Then you wouldn't have to worry about a China-Pakistan border. And so some within Pakistan are wondering, is there a deliberate effort to destabilize their country so that there would be greater control over Pakistan's relationship to its neighbors? And then if we look at the next map, this is something that reflects what a man named Pepe Escobar has written about as Pipelinistan. the United States may have designs on being able to control the transport of resources like natural gas and oil, such that the United States would be able to bring resources in a way that would make them less available to Russia or China, and therefore the United States would perhaps have an economic advantage maintained. Again, I am certainly no expert on these questions, but I think that as we examine, why does the United States want to send troops into Afghanistan to occupy bases and control roadways? I do not believe that this is entirely to protect the humanitarian concerns of people living in Afghanistan. You'll hear, but what about the women? But let's also remember, women whose husbands are imprisoned or have joined Taliban groups or perhaps have already been killed, women who are poor, with children, and single. And I'm thinking particularly of a story I was told about women who get their income from making rugs, weaving on the loom all day, hard work, just to be able to get enough money into the house to feed their children. And they can't deviate from their work or their children won't eat. But the children are bouncy, and the children want to play. And so what will they do? They can't send the children to nursery school. They can't send their children to care. They give the children opiates. And so when we learn that 44% of Afghanistan's children suffer from stunted growth, and 33% of children 1 to 5 are underweight, surely we don't want to declare that these children are our enemies. You would recall that Madeleine Albright said in 1998 on the Today Show when she was asked, should the United States go to war against Iraq? She said, if we have to use force, we must. We are the indispensable nation. We stand taller than others. We see further. Just as much as I don't want to accept the idea that the planes always come like planets on rotation, a timed bloodletting with different excuses, I don't want to accept that we are indispensable, that we automatically stand taller, that we see further with our drones. Let us see further with our hearts. Let us see further guided by the wisdom and the courage and the love of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And then we might see a future for the grandchildren, for the next generations. Thank you so much for your time. I wonder if we could get some lights on. I just wanted to give Carol a chance to look at her watch. Do we have time to do that? Oh, okay. Well, Carol had said that it would be okay to, thanks, Doug. Thank you so much, Doug, for cooperating with, that's my maiden voyage with PowerPoint. if you have any observations, ideas, questions, criticisms, this is a good time for dialogue before we hear a little more detail about the science regarding these drones and also experiences from World War II. So, ideas, questions? Thank you. I'm also just wanting to say a special welcome to Cynthia Bass, who came in.
Yeah, thank you for coming, Kathy. I heard you down at one of the Albany Dax's peace talks in the summer at Gathering Tucker with the Shrine a couple years ago, I guess. I'm just offering this little thing. About two days ago, I tied a 9-inch, 3/16 wide red satin ribbon on my finger, my right hand, and it seems inconvenient, but it's there because it's red and because of the war. And with this week and Veterans Week coming, it just kind of happened. It wasn't like an ideological plan. And I just suggest that might be adopted by other people, because one of the things I see is that the distance that people feel from the war as civilians on the home front is distancing. And I don't think that this solves that, but it reminds me that we are at war, and that's the phrase that's been in my mind a lot, because I don't think people say that to themselves very often. I'm suggesting that it probably is more often than I think, but being at war as a civilian tears at you if you think about it much, and maybe that's the way it should.
Thank you. One thing I'd also like to add on to what you said is that some of the ways that we can kind of keep our wits about us when we feel such strong desire to end these wars is to, you know, engage in some of the basics, like writing a letter to the congressperson, writing a letter to the editor, or planning a delegation that might go into your elected representative's offices with questions and say, we just want you to answer our questions. So may I urge each of you, before you leave tonight, to please stop at a table in the back to get Peaceable Assembly campaign literature. We've written up 14 questions which we think every elected representative should be asked. And we want to encourage people to form the delegations to go into offices, but also join us January 19th through February 2nd for any stretch of days you could manage. We'll be in Washington, D.C. We'll happily work out housing for you, both in places near the White House or at the Anacostia Jail. We're inviting people to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, and we'd be happy to help with nonviolence training in advance and be logistical support for people. But we're looking for people to be part of 10 consecutive days of nonviolent civil disobedience, so that we can say to the White House, we don't want to cooperate with the plans for further war. And I think that it's a very important time to be saying that, because on February 2nd, the Obama administration will submit its defense authorization spending bill. President Obama will be preparing the State of the Union message, and it will have been 1 year since the Obama administration came into office, and it's incredibly important, I believe, that people here, especially the AGA are here, especially at a time when there's some snide questioning, so where's the peace movement? The peace movement is alive and well. I've seen it in upstate New York, everywhere I've been. But I think to make our presence known inside the representatives' offices, and if you can come, please do join us in the White House during the Peaceable Assembly campaign gathering in Washington, D.C.
I agree with you that war is not the answer to all things. However, I do feel like very vulnerable, since I know that part of the world where the Taliban is, and Pakistan, I don't know about Pakistan, or I know they hate the West. They hate the Western culture and what we stand for. And I don't know how I feel if one of my relatives died in 9/11, how would I feel? I don't agree with the war in Afghanistan, but do you have any answers for how we can present ourselves to that part of the world so that they don't hate us and they don't want to terrorize us and they don't want to kill us and see the end of the Western culture?
Well, it was very helpful for me to read Jane Meyer's article in The New Yorker. She said that when the United States airmen or women inside the dimly lit trailers who are kind of coordinating drone strikes hit an area, they can see on their screen people running away, and they refer to those people as squirters. I think that people in other parts of the world who feel antagonism toward the United States often believe that the view of the United States of them and their families is that they're not worth much more than dust under our shoes. And our job, if you will, is to change that, to make it clear that we value, we prize the lives of other people on this planet, that we want to cohabitate this planet, that we don't want to be number one, that we don't want military dominance. But I think as long as other people think that our understanding of security means national security for the United States, even if it's under the guise of empire, that we won't win over hearts and minds. But we have tremendous capacity as a country to develop water purification systems, healthcare delivery systems, food distribution systems, and to help make that part of other people's lives. But if people see us as terrifying, almost like otherworldly menaces who come into their lives with our armored personnel carriers and our tanks and our D-9 bulldozers and our F-16 aircraft and our 500-pound bombs, I mean, how are they going to see us? I think we have to try hard to see how we're seen. Let me offer this as just another analogy. When I was in Gaza, I woke up one morning and I heard this drilling, and I just panicked. I thought, oh, I'm in the dentist's office. And then I realized, no, this isn't the dentist. Somebody's digging a hole outside my window. Now, that was a sign that maybe I wasn't in the safest spot, because maybe someone was digging for a tunnel that would go between Gaza and the Egyptian border. And, well, okay, you might say, well, those people digging the tunnels might be shipping Kalashnikov rifles or bullets or rocket components through the tunnels that would be used to hit people on the Israeli side of the border. And that could make you think, well, what are you going to do about people who do such things? But, you know, let's now, just for the sake of rationalism, try to imagine what kind of a tunnel would have to be created in order to ship what the United States supplies to the government of Israel, to the military in Israel. It would have to be the size of the Grand Canyon. It would be the eighth wonder of the world, such a tunnel. You'd have to have a tunnel large enough to accommodate the Apache helicopters, the laser-guided Hellfire missiles, the D-9 bulldozers, the F-16 aircraft, the 500-pound bombs, the joint defense ammunition kits. The tunnel would have to accommodate what the United States sends to help maintain the nuclear weapons system inside of Israel. You'd have to have a huge, enormous tunnel. Now, we're seen as the people who are the most militarized country on Earth, with 68% of the world's weapon sales coming from us. We gave Israel a loan, $30 billion in the summer of 2007, to spend over the next 10 years only on military and weaponry. And that same summer, we gave money to Kuwait, to Saudi Arabia, to the Emirates, saying, get more weapons from us. We have militarized so many places around the earth, terrifying people with our weaponry. Believe me, when you hear these gut-wrenching explosions, sickening thuds, ear-splitting blasts, it's terrifying. So when we send people from our largesse what they need to survive, and extend the hand of friendship, and ask the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's fine questions, trying to see the humanity in our adversaries, trying to see ourselves as we're seen by other people, then I think we won't have to worry about other people joining groups that would hit back at us, because no one would want to hit such a generous and compassionate people as we, in a way, are and could be. Because we could practice Dr. King's recommendation that neighborliness would go beyond our own neighborhood, beyond kin, race, tribe, and nation state. And that would bring about safety for the children.
I think it would be great to also make a connection to the war at home, Kathy. First, I wanted to respond to what Sherry brought up, and just to say that just as 9/11 had ended, the organization Families for Peaceful Tomorrows was started by a guy who went and talked. He had to break the news to his mother that his brother had died in 9/11. And after she stopped crying, she said, "I just don't want anybody to ever have to feel what I'm feeling." So that was how the organization was started.
Yeah, that was David Petorti.
Yeah, I just wanted to remember him. I also want to remember one of the three Johns, John Oldfield, in case nobody has had a chance to hear that he passed away this year. Presente.
Yeah, thank you, Juliana, for being with us tonight.
And the thing about the war at home is, ironically, people keep talking about the recession, and kids are getting more and more in poverty in our community. We're already 40% of the kids under 5 are poor in this city. And that's a problem, and it makes people apathetic. Ironically, in my analysis, a lot of that poverty came partly because several administrations here valued weapons over people so much that human needs have been ignored and families have not been supported. And we have a war at home. We have a war on our own poor people, poor kids. So how do we connect the needs of poor kids in this country in people's minds to that waste on weapons? How do we educate people about that, Kathy?
Well, certainly the spiral is pretty obvious to us right now. You attack another country, that country doesn't like to be attacked or occupied and fights back, then you have to get greater and more powerful means to attack and retaliate, and then you bankrupt your own country because so much of the money has been spent on the military corporations. Meanwhile, they're running to the bank and doing quite well, thank you. And because the country's economics are so damaged, the young people can't graduate from universities, they can't find jobs, and they join the military, and then you've got more military people to send. The spiral goes on. For those who aren't going to be accepted by the military, there are jail prisons to which they will be sent, and then that creates another set of jobs for people who've been forced off the land because they can't grow food. And so these spirals are there. I think a lot of people understand that. That's why we have 58% of the U.S. population against the wars. And part of our job is to galvanize people and say, if not us, who? If not now, when? And insist to our coworkers, to our family members, to those who might be vulnerable to our plea that we can't let the six-year-olds sort it out. They're not going to be able to do it. That we are the ones who have to kind of put our shoulder to the boulder and work hard, and that you don't get freedom. You have to take it. You have to exercise that right to free speech. In the wake of the wonderful celebration over all of the energy and money that was required to put President Obama into the Oval Office, I think there's a sense, well, it's rude if you go into your elected representative's office or to the White House and you raise your grievance. It's not rudeness, it's the process. It's this, quote, democratic process. Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. We have a grievance. So I think it's just not to simplify, but basically it's doing what we know how to do and wake people up again, not to be asleep at the wheel. And it doesn't help to be shrill, I know that. But I do think that particularly when we look at the people who want to shelter their children, who want to care for their children, I have friends who will arrange play dates, go to the soccer games, bus the kids back and forth to the soccer games, invest themselves in all of the entertainment. I see college kids who are calling their moms 3 times a day. The connection is so strong. Let's get that parental love out of the soccer fields, basically, out of the sports arena, and into creating a habitable planet for the children that we all love.
children and their wives and their families were being killed by these American kids at the checkpoints who would shoot at anything. And that's when the what we call the insurgency began in Iraq. Other people had different names for them. They were defending their families. And what amazes me is that in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the very same thing is happening. When they use the drones, they say they're going after one leader. So they kill one leader, and along with that, they kill 35, 45, 50 civilians. And nothing is said about that. The army says, well, they're collateral damage. Now, if you're thought of as collateral damage, I think that if our country were attacked by Canadians, and your family and your daughters and your children and your husbands were killed, you wouldn't just, it's natural to try to defend yourself. So that's what I would just like to say. And the second thing, it's wonderful for our part of the country to have Kathy here tonight, and tomorrow night at Hamilton College, we will hear Tariq Ali, who will really, what a pair. You two should be on a stage together. But anyway, it's at 7:30 tomorrow night at the chapel at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. And if you're free, they don't charge anything there. It's free and open to the public. And he is absolutely marvelous to hear, just as you were.
Thank you, Cynthia. And, Carol, for moving us along and let you all know it's been a great privilege to be here with you this evening and to hear the remainder of the program. Thank you. That works. Thank you. So thank you very much, Kathy, and thank you for everyone's comments. There will be time afterwards. We can stay longer once the program is over for people to talk. Because what I'd like to do now is we have been talking a bit about planes and bombs and destruction. And we've also talked about drones, which are unmanned in the plane, but they are personed somewhere. There are pilots somewhere, even though they aren't in the plane. And to give a little insight onto what it means to drop bombs, we have Sam Feld here, who was a bombardier during World War II, just like Howard Zinn was a bombardier during World War II. And like Howard, Sam changed his mind about weapons. And so just a few words from you, Sam, if you would, about your feelings about that.
I have a bumper sticker on my car that says, our humanity has not kept up with our technology. And I'm thinking of the drones, the antiseptic, the divorcement from a human being, and the killing of people. Carol asked me if I would talk about how I felt dropping bombs. And it's true, I dropped a lot of bombs, I killed a lot of people. I flew 30 missions. And I qualified to be a terrorist. If the definition of a terrorist is one who kills innocent civilians for a political purpose, but I was a terrorist. I killed lots of people. And not only that, even though some of our targets were military targets, there were targets that were designed to destroy cities. In Hamburg and in Dresden, for example, there's a thing called fireball, in which you send out a fleet of B-17s that drop ordinary bombs that explode. And then you send other planes that drop fireballs, incendiary bombs, that burn, and then more bombs on top of that, so it reaches such a Fahrenheit level, like 150 degrees, that it sucks up the energy and the oxygen and turns it into a furnace. Over 60,000 people died in Hamburg. In Dresden, as much as 135,000 were estimated. So who's the terrorist? It's interesting. When you're on one side, you're a hero what you do. The other side is always the terrorist. But we're all terrorists. Every war is a terrorist act. And I'm thinking, on the other side of that bumper sticker, the humanity. And I am despair to think about what's happened to our culture, what's happened to our people. Why are they broken, apathetic, fearful, lack of courage? Where is the outrage when we see an election stolen from me, from us? Where is the outrage when we see the millions and billions of dollars going to bankers and financial institutions and nothing to the people, really? Where is the outrage on the Vietnam War and Afghanistan? What is, why are we out in the streets in the hundreds of thousands to protest? We are spending $684 billion on a military budget. Unbelievable. We talk about the need to find money for things, but we give an increase to the military. $684 billion. I think I'm going to stop. I'll tell you something. I'm very pleased. I'm grateful for the Syracuse Peace Council that's out there fighting for peace and social justice every day. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sam. Now, some of you have heard the name the Johns referred to, and some of you may be familiar with that, and others not. They are John Roulet, John Gereller, and John Oldfield, who, as was mentioned, passed away recently. And they, more than anyone else locally, have had a focus on the drones since the moment we knew drones were going to be coming to Syracuse. And they, in a certain way, have been voices in the wilderness trying to wake us up to pay attention to what's happening here in our community. And so we're grateful to them for having helped wake us up. And now to speak on the drones locally here is John Roulet.
Good evening, and I'm delighted that Julianne is here. Julianne is John Oldfield's widow, and we owe her a lot for helping bring John Oldfield to this country. John Dreller's here, and I'm sure he would agree with me that John Oldfield got us started. He called us, said, look what's happening. Look what's going on. What are we going to do about it? And he had some plans. And he drew us in, not reluctantly, but he drew us in, and that's how we happened to get started. And so we started to write a few letters and things like that. But rather than go into anything of that nature, let me just tell you about what is specific to Syracuse with regard to the drones. What's specific to Syracuse and what John Oldfield was mostly concerned about was the fact that these drones are actually going to also be flying in civilian airspace. The process is the drones will be housed here in Syracuse out at Hancock Field, and that means that's where they'll be detained and serviced and things like that. Then when they're needed for training pilots and dropping bombs, they will be flown from Syracuse to the airport in Northtown, the air base. And so they will have to fly across civilian airspace in order to get there. Now, these drones are, of course, very heavily protected against radar. Their image is made to be as small as possible, and they're not allowed to carry transponders or anything like that, which normal civilian aircraft do to protect the airspace. So there's been a great potential for great danger as these planes are flown from Syracuse to Watertown. Then when they're in Watertown, the people who are piloting them will get an opportunity to drop bombs and try to kill things. Then they'll fly back to Syracuse and be serviced. And this is what was at least the last public information I had on what's going to happen. So that's the way the drones will be physically here in Syracuse. Now, people are going to say, of course, well, the FAA won't allow them to fly without proper clearance. And who knows what that's going to amount to. The drones are used heavily along the Mexican border and along the Canadian border now for surveillance. Then the worst part of this, or the additional second part of this, is that the drones that will be flying in Afghanistan will be based over in that part of the world. They're not going to fly from Syracuse. They'll be based over there, and the way they will go is that at some point in time they'll decide to start a flight, and the persons in foreign country, say Afghanistan, will actually give the commands to take the drone off the ground and get it into the sky. The takeoff phase and the landing phase will be controlled over in, say, Afghanistan. And that's because to control that from, say, here in Syracuse, there's a great time delay for the signals to pass back and forth, and it'd be very difficult to land the plane under those conditions. So over there, they'll be taken off. Then the control will be passed to the operators here in Syracuse. Right now, the only place that I know of that they're flown is from Air Force Base in Nevada. And this will be the first civilian, let us say, the first area that is civilian that will be flying those drones in battle. So we have something very unique. Syracuse, a lot of unique things about it. One of the unique things is we will be personally involved killing people in Afghanistan from Syracuse. and there's no other civilian population that can make that claim. I think we should do something about that. Like Sam was saying, where's the rage? Where's the rage about this? So we'll be flying the planes, then once they're airborne, there will be two people in the room, at least two people in the room, one person being that pilot that will send the signals to the plane. The other person will be the observer to gather all the information that is being gathered by the sensors that are on the drone. And like Cynthia, or excuse me, Kathy indicated, there's tremendous information that is there. They can zero in on the face of a person and say, yes, that person is there. It's not just that they're getting a broad picture of things, but they know exactly what they're looking at. So if they decide, whoever in this room making the decision to kill, and this has to be a third party, probably someone from the CIA, someone has to decide, who are we going to go after? Who are we going to kill? Well, this is assassination. You're going after a single person because of his political position. That's assassination. And by international law, from my understanding, that's illegal. And at some point, I would trust that some legal eagles are going to pick up on this and bring a case to the world court against the United States for violating the rules of war. Because we're assassinating people because of their position. And that's there's no hiding that. In addition, there's all the collateral damages as referred to. So as you go to kill that person, unfortunately for the collateral people, the bullet isn't just directed at that person, but it's a weapon like a Hellfire missile or something that kills a lot around the area. This is going to be going in Syracuse, from Syracuse, and we're going to have people doing that. And as our former Congressman Walsh said, the nice thing about having the drones here is that the people who fly them can do their job during the day, and after they're through, go home, have dinner in Camillus with their families. Now, you can imagine, let that sink a little bit, what we're trying to say. There's nothing to this other than driving to work. So anyway, that's part of the story. The weapons will be fired, or the killing will be done from here, and we will be deciding who lives and dies. Now, I'd like to say just one or two things more. This is technically what's going on. There was a question raised, why do they hate us? Well, I've had an opportunity to do a fair amount of traveling, and I have some friends in other countries, and I'll ask them this question. What is it? Well, we're so damn cockeyed. We're so proud of ourselves. We're so powerful that we carry this to our interpersonal relations. For example, we all refer to ourselves as Americans, and we're from America. This is the height of hypocrisy. We're not America. We're the United States of America. And to say we're Americans is doing a disservice to the Canadians, the Mexicans, the other people throughout the Americas. There's North and South America. And this is what we don't really appreciate, is just the way we talk and the way we act makes people not like us. And the one I'm talking to is a good friend of mine that laid it out to me, just like I'm talking to you. So we have to do a lot, not only not kill them and drop bombs on them, but we also have to get down inside of us and what is it that makes us act the way we do. Finally, the thing I want to close on is I was talking to Dan Lefay about the drones. And I was saying, you've got to, you know, this was before the vote came. He said, he's going to vote for the drones. And I said, well, why? What is it? And as I pushed him, we talked for about 10 minutes, as I pushed him on this, it finally came out, jobs. This is about 74th, the Air National Guard here is going to lose their F-16s. So that means all the pilots are going to be out of work. And by getting the drones come here, there's going to be a lot of new jobs. And that's what it is. It's jobs. And the way jobs get utilized is they get funded by Congress. And Congress represents us. And if Congress is voting to fund these horrible wars, that's because they think they can get away with it. And if they had some other view on it, then perhaps they would change. But if they don't have another view of it, why is that? It's because we don't go after them strong enough to say you've got to change the way you're voting. So we can point fingers around, but it all comes back to us.
And I'd like to acknowledge John Jereller, who's one of the Johns.
Thank you. I just wanted to refer back to Kathy's talk, and she mentioned the New Yorker article. I read through that article, and one of the things that I learned from going through it is that the U.S. Air Force is not too happy with the drone activity in Pakistan because it's the CIA who's operating the drones in Pakistan. They're out to kill the Taliban. And the Air Force sees this as compromising their mission in Afghanistan. So, in further reading in the article, we find out that, yes, it is the CIA who's doing the killing. The Obama administration has urged them to ramp it up, not calm it down. And the suggestion now is that the CIA will be hiring private pilots. Therefore, we have citizens engaging in military operations. Isn't that a terrorist? Yeah. So, and we don't know where the CIA is flying out of, supposedly Langley, Virginia. But that's not for certain. It certainly could be out of Nevada. More than just what we had just first anticipated, namely the military operating here out of Hancock. We now find that the CIA is involved in a very covert operation, so this becomes even scarier. And of course, as John alluded to, but it does make Hancock a direct military base and a legitimate target. And that makes all of us legitimate collateral damage. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And it looks like there's other people who want to talk. There will be plenty of time for talking afterwards. because we're trying to keep this to about an hour and a half. I would like to do a little part first, and then we can see where we're at. Because I'd like to do the handout part. And the handout part is, first off, this is a free event, but there are expenses associated. And please, whatever you're able to put in, if not, don't worry about it. But it's just to give us a hand in paying for the space and making some donations. So this is the first part. Okay, the next part is what's coming up this Sunday. First off, if anyone would like to read more about the drones, there's a piece, the last issue of the Peace Newsletter has a story about the drones written by Ed Canan. There are three copies on the table in the back. So please pick one of those up. Also, and if you don't have a chance to get to this before we close, we'll have these at the table also. So the Peace Council sign-up sheet, and what you can get is we have a weekly e-newsletter to let you know about upcoming events and if you'd like to get involved. But in particular, if you would like to continue working on the drones after Sunday, please indicate your interest and we'll see what we can put together. One of the things we're interested in is using this as a way to focus on our opposition to the war in Afghanistan. So it's the drones within that context. So I'm going to just pass this out. I have two of them. And if it doesn't get to you and you wish it had, it will be available afterwards. The other thing, a lot of stuff. Looks like Kathy will be my assistant. Would you be my assistant? Thank you. We have flyers on the event coming up Sunday. I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. If you want a flyer, if you want to take as many as you feel that you can reasonably post, in other words, don't recycle them. And I'm going to pass these out here too. We have small ones and big ones, and they'll also be available. That will help too. We need lots of those. Thank you. And as they're passing it out, it's just going to tell you what's happening. What's happening? This Sunday is a day full of activities focused on the drones in Syracuse. If there is only one thing you can do, the thing to do is from 1:30 to 2:15 p.m. be at the entrance to the Hancock Air National Guard Base, where we will have a picket for 45 minutes, not knowing what the weather is going to be like in Syracuse on November 15th. We'll be moving, although people who have mobility issues will try to find a spot where you have a lawn chair section, if you would like that. So that if you have one thing you can do, that's the thing to do. We'll be carpooling from Arc Range. If you go to the Peace Council website, there's maps on how to get there. There's maps on how to get to the base. Or just meet us there. And there's information on here on where to park. If you have more time than that, there are a number of other things you could do to participate. One is there's going to be a spirited march from Art Rage, which is a political art gallery, to the base. It's about 5 miles. And it's going to be starting at 10:30 a.m. and very spirited. Also, if you would like to gather beforehand at Art Rage at noon, we're going to have soup and a light lunch. And this is in part two because there are people from around the region who are coming, and we want to offer them some hospitality, and we want to offer hospitality to anyone else who wants to participate in the action. Then we'll have some brief talks, our rage, probably about 15 or 20 minutes. Kathy will say a few words, just say something, so we'll have other things said. And then we'll carpool to the floor, the picket, the thing that if you only have one thing you can do, that's what you're doing. And then afterwards, what we'll do if, for people who are interested is come back to Art Rage for a cake and ice cream birthday celebration of local activist Cynthia Bannis, who spoke a little bit ago. Cynthia, raise your hand, who is turning 80. And following that, because of the expected people from around the region, we're going to have a regional meeting to talk about strategizing regionally around the drones in Syracuse. And if people are interested in participating in that, you are very, very welcome to do so. So if anyone has any questions about what's happening, let me know, and I'd be happy to answer them. Couple other pieces about this, I have to refer to my notes here. We are having a sign and making party because pickets need signs. And that will be this Friday the 13th at 7 p.m. at the Peace Council, which is on the second floor of the Syracuse Center for Peace and Social Justice. It's near the corner of Westcott and East Genesee. Again, the directions are on the website if you're not familiar with the location. Another thing, one of the things we will be doing at the picket to close it is that the Peace Council has written a letter of protest about the drones, which we will deliver. Other groups are welcome to do that too, or as individuals. So if you want to do that in a group of friends, group you belong to, or just yourself, write something and we'll put the letters together and bring them to the guardhouse. Couple other things is that if you have some time, there's still a couple jobs that need to be done around this. One is we're looking for photographers, because you might notice that sometimes our kinds of events are covered and sometimes they're not. The best way to make sure they're covered is for us to cover them ourselves. So if anyone likes to take pictures, please see me. We'd love to have you do that. As well as if anybody is a videographer or even an amateur videographer who'd be willing to put something up on YouTube afterwards, we really welcome that. And please see me about that. Also, if anybody in the next couple days has a little bit of extra time and would like to come by the SPC office and help with errands and other things that are happening in order to make this happen, please see me about that. So any questions, ask. Is this a question about the event? Okay.
Is there a clear description of this? There's some of you in the place, like this is a peace action.
We have applied for a permit through the town of DeWitt. And that's all anybody knows about it. Yes, a question. Another question about this.
Carol, who do we address letters to specifically?
Good question. I don't have that in my mind. Ed?
I don't have it.
We're sorry. We'll put it, excuse me?
You want to answer that? As far as police?
We can put it on the website unless somebody knows right off the top of their heads, because we have addressed it, but it's not in our minds. It's a very good question.
Well, as long as somebody said before, if you're going to hear from us, you're going to hear from
So you said Colonel W. Colonel Bradley?
Captain W. Bradley.
Kevin W. Bradley, 174th. If somebody wants the information, talk to him. Because he said it pretty fast and you probably haven't memorized it or been able to write it down. But if you want it tonight, he's got it. Other questions about the event itself? Well, I really, really hope to see you all there. Or at least for part of it. So just pick the piece that works for you. Come for the whole day, or just come for a piece of it. But we really have to get this going, and as you can see, we're part of it. We're part of this war, and we have to stop it right here at home. So with that, I think it's time to close. So thank you all so much for coming. I know there's people who want to say things. Julianne wants to say something, who is the widow of John.
I just feel on behalf of John, I would just like to say that initially, he was incensed at the whole idea of drones, long before knowing that they were going to come to Syracuse. And so I just would like to point that he really was deeply upset by the immorality of the whole idea of drones. And then he saw them coming to Syracuse as a means to get people worked up, to get us all outraged. And from my own point of view, I would just like to say that I don't think it's just a question of trying to learn to love people from the other side of the world and areas where we call them terrorists. I think we're going to have to go down on our knees and beg for forgiveness. And I think we should not expect to be forgiven for quite a long time.
Thank you. So thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Feel free to stay and mingle and talk and pick up material, sign sheets, grab more things to post. And thank you. See you Sunday.